the final lecture of UKLA 2016. It's an absolute pleasure to introduce Gabrielle Cliff Hodges today. Gabrielle is senior lecturer at the University of Cambridge. She's a long-standing, highly valued member of UKLA. Her work for National Committee, for Executive Committee, is second to none, and obviously for the National Association for Teaching of English. She's published widely, and many colleagues will be familiar with her research exploring students' perspectives and what motivates them as readers, into work that probes really deeply into the process and experience of reading for pleasure and purpose, and also for her powerful arguments on why literature matters. Gabrielle is also known for her integrity, her thoughtfulness, her humanity, as well as her formidable intellect. And these are all qualities that I know will shine through her talk today. In 2013, I got to experience those qualities first up when she co-edited a special issue on narrative and literacy for Literacy. And in the editorial for that issue, it begins with the statement, "Narratives are not just fictional stories through which we make sense of or mirror an existing world. They produce us and reproduce us as recognisable human subjects and are vital in producing our social and ethical relations with the world." This particular moment in time, it's never really seemed more important to revisit the role of narratives, both in reflecting and producing who we are. And I'm really looking forward to Gabrielle exploring this particular theme with us today. So please welcome Gabrielle Cliff Hodges.
Okay, good morning. Thank you very much, Cathy. This lecture is a memorial lecture, and it's therefore in part about memory. But one of Harold Rosen's passionate interests was stories and their meanings, so that's what I'm also going to focus on this morning. I was never actually taught by Harold. He'd retired from the London Institute of Education by the time I did my master's there, but he still influenced my thinking. Two of his works made a particular impact. The first was called The Dramatic Mode, in which he argues that dramatic behaviour and dramatic language are a common human resource. Although he found some of the classroom drama that he observed as a teacher educator a bit artificial, he argued that drama in the classroom can be liberating because it can propose areas of attention that the pupils themselves would not propose. It's a means of moving towards collective wisdom. A second work of Harold's which really influenced me was his Stories and Meanings. In it, Harold argues passionately for the value of storytelling and why it matters that young people tell their own stories in the classroom. Harold was emphatic that stories by working class children be told in the children's own language and valued. As Tony Burgess notes, Harold valued pupils' language for the quality of their speech, shaped by interest and experience and their own meanings. Harold himself was a great storyteller. He features in Betty Rosen's wonderful account of Friday afternoon storytelling sessions in the classroom, and none of it was nonsense. And he included a selection of his own stories and articles in Troublesome Boy. Troublesome Boy contains, as I'm sure many of you will know, traditional stories such as Avram's Overcoat, which Harold transforms and retells. Avram's Overcoat is about a poor Jewish tailor who wore a magnificent overcoat he'd made until it was almost completely threadbare. Before it disintegrated completely, Avram cut off some of the better bits of material left to make a jacket. Later, he transformed the jacket into a waistcoat until the waistcoat wore out. Then there was only enough material left to make a skull cap. The very last scrap of material was used to cover a button. When that was worn through, Avram thought he was left with nothing. But not quite. He realised he was left with a story, the one he'd just told. Upcycling is what we might call that now. Not only what was done with the overcoat, but also with the story. Harold often refashioned bits of his own autobiography as stories. For example, he crafted recollections of himself being in detention into a story called Not Yet, when he was a schoolboy. It's cut out and sewn together from some very vivid memories. I love this vignette of a boy called Mo. For example, quote, keeping up a grumbling mutter, looking up occasionally to the ceiling with his eyes shut, and then down again to an open book. This was his regular learning something by heart performance. The climax of the story comes when another boy, Hoffman, lets off the fire extinguisher, and it ends poignantly with the utter humiliation of the teacher. We are our stories, Harold writes. We are all storytellers, if only we are given the chance. The influence of Harold's work is captured in Changing English, Essays for Harold Rosen, a collection which his colleagues put together to mark his retirement. In the introduction, Margaret Meek says, in his long and distinguished career, Harold has been a doughty fighter for social and intellectual regeneration. Every domain represented in this volume has something of his work lurking in it, as an influence, an inspiration, or even a disagreement, for Harold likes a good argument. Since Harold liked a good argument, there were bound to be things in this talk that I'm sure he would have taken issue with. But remembering him has certainly made me think very carefully about what I'm going to say. I still think, though, he'd have been interested in one of my key questions, which is, do drama, stories and meanings still matter today to teachers and the young people we teach? And if so, why? Since 100 years ago today, to this very day actually, the Battle of the Somme was raging. Over 1 million people in many different parts of the world had been killed by the final day of the battle in November 1916. The scale of and nature of World War I is almost unimaginable. But even after 100 years, it remains vividly present to a great many people. Why is that? There are public ceremonies and built memorials, but that's by no means the whole reason. I think it's also to do with stories, meanings, drama. For example, in 2014, there was an online project called Letter to an Unknown Soldier. People were invited to imagine the letter that's portrayed as being read by the unknown soldier in the statue at Paddington Station in London. Many school children imagined his story and wrote the letters they thought he might have been reading. Then they sent them off to be uploaded onto the project website where they can still be read. Poetry also continues to be an important way in which people record their thoughts and feelings about World War I. Simon Armitage, for example, writes about the land on which the Battle of the Somme was fought in his new collection, Still, which is being published this coming week. His poems are apparently a response to the glass plate photographs that were taken by pilots flying over the Somme in 1916. Histories, poems, photographs, autobiographies, letters, diaries, and retellings of first-hand experiences are some of the many reasons why we remember. But what particular contribution do narratives, stories, and novels make? One way in which many young people in the early 21st century have learned about World War I is through the storytelling of children's writer Michael Morpurgo, especially novels like War Horse. Morpurgo says that he was moved to write War Horse by a picture of a horse which hung in his village hall. From that and from older villagers' stories, Morpurgo created a novel with a horse, Joey, as narrator crossing between soldiers on different sides of the war. The story was then turned into a play by the National Theatre and the Handspring Puppet Company. I'm not sure what Harold would have made of it. Perhaps, like some contemporary theatre critics, he would have thought it overly stilted and unconvincing. Personally, I found the puppetry brilliant. For me too, the play is a powerfully imagined representation of war. It's also an extraordinary multimodal and multisensory experience of a particularly inhumane episode in history, made affective by live music, digitised sound effects, lighting, props, and Ray Smith's very striking set designs. At the end of War Horse, an elderly, bereaved French grandfather is given these words to speak about his granddaughter, Emily. He says to the departing soldiers, I shall die soon, and then no one will remember my Emily as she was. I have no other family left alive to remember her. She will be just a name on a gravestone that no one will read. So I want you to tell your friends at home about my Emily. Otherwise, it will be as if she had never even lived. Will you do this for me? That way, she will live forever. The grandfather's words seemed to echo Morpurgo's belief in the power of storytelling to keep memory alive. The question in my title comes from a song called Only Remembered. It's sung on stage during the play version of War Horse. That song, as it happens, is a transformation too. Originally, I thought it was a traditional folk song, but it isn't. It's actually a 19th century gospel hymn from America. This is the verse my title comes from. Who'll sing the anthem and who will tell the story? Will the line hold? Will it scatter and run? Shall we at last be united in glory, only remembered for what we have done? Those words actually were added to the song later. I'm not sure who added them. And the song is now a protest against the idea of war. You can hear it sung on the No Glory in War website. In 2014, Michael Morpurgo produced an anthology called Only Remembered. The book includes pictures and writing chosen by famous people. There's a poem in it by Carol Ann Duffy called Last Post. She imagines in an extraordinary moving image what would happen if, like rewinding a film, poetry could tell it backwards. If poetry could rewind and tell it backwards, she says, then fallen soldiers would get back up and go home instead of being slaughtered like cattle for the glory of their country. She imagines dying men being rewound into life. All those thousands dead are shaking dried mud from their hair and queuing up for home. But in reality, that doesn't happen. Instead, people die. But if they are remembered, perhaps it's not only for what they have done. 10 days ago, on Friday the 1st of July, at the anniversary of the first day of the Battle of the Somme, an installation called Hashtag We Are Here offered a different kind of memorial. Some of you saw it. It was created by the artist Jeremy Deller and artistic theatre director Rufus Norris. Volunteers from all walks of life secretly rehearsed being World War I soldiers. Then on Friday, dressed in World War I army uniforms, they set out in groups to stand, sit, or walk silently in different places across the country. They were like ghosts. They didn't speak. Norris didn't want them to. He said, if they speak, they become reenactors, living history. He wanted them to have a detached quality to them. There is no narrative. They're not playing or acting men who fought. They are a presence. So if anyone spoke to them, the soldiers handed out a card giving the name and dates of one of the men who died at the Somme. Norris said, in the 21st century, I felt we had to do something different. So I thought about the memorial being human and travelling around the country. It would take itself to the public rather than the public taking itself to the memorial. And also, the public wouldn't know in advance that there was this thing happening. They would encounter it. Encountering is a good way to describe what we do with narrative. To encounter means to come up against, to meet with. In narratives, there are encounters to be had between narrators, listeners, viewers, writers, readers. But what is it that encourages so many young people to enjoy narratives? Perhaps in part it is the encounter with other people and other ideas. Perhaps too it's that narrative is a particularly powerful way of communicating. As Harold Rosen knew, narratives involve selecting ideas, organising them into new sequences, and hence making new meanings. Classrooms are good places to encounter and discuss novels like War Horse. They're also good places to discuss, compare and contrast very different experiences of different wars, especially via rich children's literature. For example, there are powerful novels such as The Breadwinner by Deborah Ellis about the impact of the Taliban and in Afghanistan and what Pavana, the protagonist, must endure in order to survive. Or equally powerful novels like Elizabeth Laird's mentioned yesterday, a little piece of ground, for example, which depicts the experiences, as she said, of Palestinian boys living under military occupation. It offers a very different perspective again, but still focuses on the extreme harshness of war and of living under occupation. Carol Fox, in an article about the children's literature of war, argues that children's literature is one of the most powerful media for communicating to children what war is, what it is like, what it means, and what its consequences are. In other words, for empathy. Representations of war in other media can, of course, generate empathy as well. But, says Fox, novels about wars afford young readers particularly good opportunities to consider ethical issues of all kinds, to explore different cultures, and to find out how nations and groups characterise themselves. It's important, too, I think, to remember the potential of other kinds of texts that young people enjoy reading. For example, The Breadwinner could be read alongside the moving report called The Children of Kabul, which was made by a young children's BBC Newsround reporter called Nell, who was originally from Afghanistan. Viewers of her report learn about the precarious existence of people, especially children, in Kabul. Both the film report and the novel are vivid, horrifying, and moving, but bringing both together provides a chance for young people to adopt a critical position. Many young people are very interested in comparing and contrasting different perspectives. They relish and learn from the intellectual process. Robert Scholes, author of Textual Power, says we should encourage just such intellectual processes because they lead readers towards acquiring textual power. Textual power, he says, involves three processes: reading, interpretation, and criticism. That means reading when we're completely immersed in the world of the text, reading when we're jolted out of our immersion to deal with issues of interpretation, and reading when we take an even further step back from the text to review it critically, to speak back, not merely to be compliant. All those three processes, though, interconnect. Therefore, we don't learn about them from being taught first one, and then the next, and then the next. We learn from experiencing all three in the context of real texts, understanding how they work together as an integral whole. Ian McGilchrist, in his book The Master and His Emissary, it's a fascinating book about the hemispheres of the brain, he writes about the ways in which each hemisphere has different roles to play. One of the hemispheres, for example, attends to close-up detail, while the other looks to breadth of perspective. Our overall perceptions, though, rely on the work of both of them interconnecting. Stories and novels, particularly whole stories and whole novels, offer the same kinds of experience. We have to attend closely to the detail, and at the same time, we have to grasp the arc of the narrative and the context in which it's developing. Both must interconnect. As Marianne Wolfe says in Proust and the Squid, just as reading reflects the brain's capacity for going beyond the original design of its structures, reading also reflects the reader's capacity to go beyond what is given by the text and the author. Non-fiction goes beyond just as much as fiction, and texts like this BBC News school report called What's Life Like at School in Syria, made by school students for this project, is a non-fiction text, but one which also enables young writers and readers to develop textual power. It presents factual information expressly in the context of emotions, as the reporter's subtitle makes clear: news values, why emotions matter. Scholes, McGilchrist and Wolfe are all arguing for readers' experiences of all kinds of text and reading to be interconnected and complex, not simplistic. It's 50 years ago since the Dartmouth Conference in the United States, when representatives from England and the United States met for a month. We've been here for 2 days. They met for a month in Dartmouth in America to debate the scope and nature of English teaching across the Atlantic Divide. Although the Dartmouth Conference is not so much known about now, it is still part of the story of English teaching. So it's important to remember a bit about it. An account was written up by John Dixon in Growth Through English, exploring the move that was being made from a skills and cultural heritage model of English towards one in which going beyond was a prime aim. In this instance, going beyond came to be known as personal growth. It aimed to help students broaden their knowledge and understanding of the subject and encourage them to use language in more creative and relevant ways. Harold Rosen was there and played an important role in pressing for change. But rereading Dixon's Growth Through English recently, I was struck by what his account does not include. I therefore just want to spend a few minutes remembering one of the women who did not go, but whose work as a primary school teacher was influential on the conference and is worth remembering. The way she taught sits interestingly alongside what Harold was advocating about stories and meanings, but in a very different rural setting. That woman is Sybil Marshall, and her book, Experiment in Education, is the story of her time as the sole teacher and head teacher of a one-form village school of 28 children. Kingston, the village, is just a few miles outside Cambridge. In the 1950s, when Marshall taught there, most of her pupils were farm labourers' children, plus a few Italian children who ended up in the village because of the Second World War, and a few children of professional people. Small villages and rural schools then, as much as now, are often more multifarious than they're given credit for. Experiment in Education is about how Sybil Marshall taught the children through what she termed a symphonic method of planning. The metaphor stemmed from her using Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony as a theme for one term's work. The children also did a project on the life and history of their village, Kingston, incorporating a range of reading, writing, dance, collage, art, nature study, history, geography, maths. Marshall points out that her symphonic method, like a symphony itself, allows for second subjects, variations, differences of tempo, and indeed wholly separate movements. Yet the term's work, like a symphony, is only completely satisfactory as an entire whole. Marshall, who came from the Cambridgeshire Fens herself, ensured that children not only used but appreciated the richness of their local dialects, just as Harold was advocating children in London should do. Her approach to teaching gave them plenty of opportunity to explore things for themselves, guided by her teaching, and to tell stories, their own and those of the village in which they were growing up. Marshall's 5 to 11-year-olds were, therefore, before the Dartmouth Conference had even taken place, enacting a form of personal growth. But we can make connections between her work and comparable work in classrooms today. Eve Byrne, in And What Do You Think Happened Next?, analyses some multimodal work done by primary school children with their teacher and local authority advisor in Newham. The children discussed how authors and artists have made meanings through multimodal texts in the past and throughout the world, for example, cave paintings, Aboriginal art, story scrolls, music, and dance. Then they read and critically analysed complex picture books by contemporary artists and writers. Finally, they drew on digital photography to inform their own poetry writing, showing how attending to people's bodies might lead to empathising with their emotions. So these children in 21st century Newham are thus related to the children in mid-20th century Kingston. They may be distanced by time, but they are connected by their teachers' planning for their learning and by the vibrant work they all produced. In the process, their teachers learnt a great deal about them. As a teacher educator myself, I'm keen to encourage student teachers to learn as much as they can about the students with whom they work, not least those in rural areas who are often overlooked. I regularly use one particular teaching activity which is designed to attend to the distinctiveness of individual human experiences, but also to the harmonies that are created when they're brought together. This activity starts with Kevin Crossley Holland's story, Sea Time, a story he describes as a fractured narrative. It's based on the legend of the East Anglian town of Dunwich, gradually toppling into the sea as the coastline erodes. Crossley Holland retells the legend from multiple points of view, imagining how different characters, human characters like the Bell Woman and the Fisherman, or non-human characters like the Bell and the Storm, and mythical characters like the Sea God, might speak. So I asked the student teachers to read the story aloud, using the affordances of their different voices to draw out the many perspectives which create the story. Then they write their own fractured narrative for multiple voices based on a different legend. The sections are all linked together as they are in Crossley Holland's story. And the final piece of work is designed to be read aloud collaboratively. However, new technologies are constantly changing the story. Recently, for example, sonar imaging equipment has made it possible for scientists from Southampton University to map the town beneath the sea, which has previously been impossible because of the muddiness of the water. So new perspectives are constantly being added. I took the story with me to when I went to Singapore, and despite some misgivings about whether or how it would work, I used it in a workshop with Singaporean teachers who created their own very vibrant version based on a local legend there of how Singapore acquired its name, Lion City. The activity therefore works both locally and globally, but it also, of course, embodies our conference title, Literacy, Equality and Diversity, Bringing Voices Together. I've always taught in Cambridgeshire, and I know how diverse a place it is. But another reason I know is because I've always tried to combine teaching with research, however small scale, conducting my own and also reading other people's. This BIRA RSA study, Research and the Teaching Profession, argues why it's so important for teachers to be research literate, research active, and work in research-rich environments. It suggests that students are entitled to be taught by teachers who know why things work rather than simply what works. Doing research and reading other people's can change the way we perceive things. The way we conduct that research can also help us realise the diversity of people's experiences, especially if, as Brian Street said on Friday, we aim for research that is telling rather than typical. I've always been interested in the relationship between real and imagined places, and I thought everyone else was too. Some of the research I undertook for my master's showed me it was not as simple as that. I did a case study of different ways in which a Year 7 class use narratives in reading, writing, talk and drama. My thesis was called We Have Been In It All Through the Story. The words, we have been in it all through the story, were spoken by one of the students in role as a character in an improvised drama. The drama lasted over several lessons. It was about a village which flooded over to create a reservoir. It was inspired by an article by Jonathan Neelands, which I don't think is any longer available, but was an early version of many of his later ideas about acting together and ensemble work. The drama involved the class creating an imaginary village called Taliban. The students were villagers living there until it was flooded. The students as villagers devised a play within a play based on the imagined history and culture they'd created for their village. The purpose of this play within the play was to try and persuade the people who wanted to flood the village to change their minds. The students hadn't, until that point, found the village wholly compelling. But perhaps because, unlike civil marshals, it wasn't their own village, but an imagined one. But, as one of them later acknowledged, within the drama, the prospect of that village that they'd created being flooded outraged them. And because the village was made up, they saw an opportunity and seized it. Now, in their play within the play, they felt they could rise above the ordinary and revel in the fantastical, which is what so many of them really enjoyed. One student said, because we have to make up Taliban's history, we can have monsters and murders instead of just normal everyday life. I'm William Sykes, but I can also be a monster. The drama concluded with imagining a very hot summer many years later when the reservoir unexpectedly dried out. The villagers could then walk in the space where Taliban had once been. One of the students afterwards recalled that moment in the drama studio when the class enacted visiting the dried out reservoir and walking among the remains of their former village. He said, we were looking at nothing that was nothing in the first place. Well, Taliban was what we made up, and really, it was nothing. It was just ruins. We were supposed to be looking at nothing, which was, in real life, nothing. What he attempts to articulate here is the vivid reality of an imagined story and the simultaneous being involved and not being involved in creating narrative texts. Harold Rosen explains in the dramatic mode that for drama to be effective, we must know it for what it is. We have to construe the here and now event as both happening and not happening. It is the imposition of design on events which makes the difference. That's precisely what these students appeared to be doing. They understood how the here and now event was both happening and not happening, or as Daniel Hahn taught us on Friday, there was and there was not. But the design of the drama, stretched out across several weeks of lessons, helped them to think about meanings, for example, what it might mean to be evicted from your home. With this same Year 7 class, I was at the time reading Jill Patton Walsh's book, Gaffer Sampson's Luck. I personally thought the Fenland setting was very powerful. At the start of the novel, the protagonist, James, is moving with his family from Yorkshire to the Fens. "We can't be nearly there," said James from the back seat of his car. "Here isn't anywhere. It's been nowhere for miles. No up, no down, no trees, nothing." "It's the Fens," his father said. "But when we get there, Dad, please, Dad, there will be something, won't there? We're not going to live on this, Dad." Getting used to an unfamiliar landscape is akin to getting into a novel. Moreover, getting a wider view of the world is not only what readers do when beginning a new book, but also, it seems, what historians do as well when representing the past. The historian John Gaddis says, "If you think of the past as a landscape, then history is the way we represent it. And it's that act of representation that lifts us above the familiar to let us experience vicariously what we can't experience directly, a wider view." The prospect of reading Gaffer Sampson's Luck initially seemed to hold little interest for the class, just as the Fen landscape holds little interest for James. Indeed, Ben, one of the Year 7 students, objected to the book being imposed on him as a class reader. In his reading journal, he wrote, "We have to read a book called Gaffer Sampson's Luck, and here's why he doesn't want to. It sounds boring, because there are no secret alien bases, no tripods striding across the skyline, and no UFOs zapping people's brains." Well, there was a chink of an opportunity because he went on to say the blurb tells us that there's a hunt for an ancient luck charm. When the students eventually became engaged in Gaffer Sampson's Luck, and they did, it was partly due to the ambiguous powers of that ancient luck charm which drew them in. But it was also, I think, the wider view of the world which the novel offered. Later on in the same unit of work, I asked the class to write their own mystery story set in the Fens. I looked forward to seeing whether Jill Patton Walsh's vivid depiction of the landscape might have oozed its way into their writing. But no. Instead, what happened was the students took firm control and wrote what they really wanted to. Ben, for example, defiantly made his own choices in a story he called The Mystery of Thompson Place. It begins like this. "Old Thompson's got himself a UFO," said Father, as he put down the paper. "What?" said Mother. "UFO over Thompson's place," said Father. "Great, can I go and look, Mum?" said Pete. Yeah. The students were, of course, familiar with the local landscape already. The place where I was teaching was right on the edge of the Fens. They often bicycled along flat cycle paths, fished in the nearby river, or worked with their parents who farmed the land. For them, the landscape was routine, not special, and ironically, not relevant. The word relevant comes from the French roulevé, which actually means to bring something into relief. A relief carving is one which stands out, not one that's engraved. However, when people talk about reading or writing which is relevant, they usually mean what's familiar, not what stands out as being different. What Ben and countless other young readers and writers like is something which is relevant because it's different, not the same, like the monsters and murders in the villagers' play. The American academic Amy Azzano has written a lot about students in rural schools in America. She argues that although many rural American students may appear to be similar, for example, because they feel strong connections with the places where they live, they're still very different. Nevertheless, they're still liable to be stereotyped, for example, as rednecks. Teachers, she argues, therefore urgently need to understand them better as individuals, not cluster them together as if they were all the same. Certain research methodologies may be better suited to understanding the distinctiveness of young people as individuals than others are, for example, those which draw on case study approaches. Azzano's own case study of a male teacher in Blue Valley shows how well-intentioned his attempts were to make the students' education relevant, but they're marred by the assumption that they all share his perspective, for example, on religion or pastimes or food preferences. Azzano uses her research very sensitively, both in its descriptions and in her analysis of the data, to show how much more complex the situation actually is. The teacher tries hard, but he doesn't pay careful enough attention. Azzano, meanwhile, as researcher, uses her research to try and adopt a wider view. Her work reminds us that as both teachers and researchers, we have a responsibility to find out what different young writers and readers actually think and know. The cultural geographer Doreen Massey discusses how the research field has traditionally been construed as a place to which researchers, like explorers, go for first-hand immediate experience. Then they retreat to their study to analyse and develop theory, analyse data and develop theory. However, what Massey says researchers ought to do instead is acknowledge their position in relation to the field, especially the different claims to knowledge and power which the field invites. A researcher who views fieldwork as a form of conquest will make different claims from one who views fieldwork as an encounter. She says it should be a real two-way engagement. Many imaginations of the field have pictured it as static. A revision of that imaginary world would make the field itself dynamic. It would make field work into a relation between two active agents. It would recognise it as a two-way encounter. The word encounter, you'll remember, was used about the hashtag We Are Here installation, but it works very well, I think, in the context of research too. Smith and Wilhelm's study, Reading Don't Fix No Chevys, Literacy in the Lives of Young Men, is an example of just such an encounter between active researchers and participants. Smith and Wilhelm undertook a study with a selection of adolescent young men in the United States, using a variety of research methods to find out what these young men actually knew about literacy and what they used literacy for. Like many other researchers, Smith and Wilhelm were drawing on what Gonzales, Moll and Amanti call funds of knowledge, and we've heard quite a lot about that in the conference. Teresa Kremin, Marilyn Mottram and others have done likewise in researching literacy lives. So has Lynn Wiltsey in her work on student teachers and Canadian Aboriginal students in schools. However, the point about funds of knowledge is not simply to draw on them, but to scaffold students' learning using them. It's completely the opposite approach to those who are advocating teaching powerful knowledge of the culture first. Susan Jones and Joe McIntyre argue against this very point in their work on young people's filmmaking, in which film is used to create alternative narratives for the community. They say, at a time when modes of learning are often predicated upon ideologies which frame knowledge as a fixed entity and the identities of learners as predefined, finding ways of engaging in collaborative projects with real purposes and outcomes and which draw on the resources offered by communities has the power to change the ways in which we consider English learning in and out of the classroom. English teachers have always been in a very strong position, I think, to learn about and draw on students' funds of knowledge, urged on by educators such as Harold Rosen, to attend not only to what children know, but to understand what they mean as well. It's what English lessons are particularly good for, creating texts, making meanings, debating them, watching, listening, drawing, acting, responding, arguing, and gaining textual power. You can do it in research too, with different research methods like small group interviews. In an article about reading with families, which I wrote a little while back, I've given an example of what can be learnt from a girl called Jessica, who was talking about her father in just such a small group interview. I asked her, "And how come you think your dad knows you well as a reader?" And Jessica said, "Because he reads quite a lot as well. So some of the books he says that I should read because he thinks they're really good as well." And I said, "And do you?" "Yeah, quite a few of them, but some of them are more like adult books, quite difficult." But she then went on to say, "Sometimes as well, I tell him books that I've read that I think he should read." "And does he?" "Yeah, well, I read the Mallory Blackman ones, Noughts and Crosses and everything, and he read the first one." I'm not sure I'd ever would have predicted that, but as a systematic research method, like semi-structured small group interviews, it can reveal complex and reciprocal parent-child reading relationships, which led me to change my thinking. Good research methods, like good storytelling, lead us to ask different questions, search out different evidence, find new patterns, and suggest different tentative meanings. Gaining different perspectives may be part of the reason why the Rivers of Reading research method, which I devised in conjunction with a class teacher as part of my PhD work, continues to be successful. Firstly, I think it's a strong teaching activity because it acknowledges students' own reading, in which they are the experts and to which they are also ascribing significance. Secondly, the Rivers of Reading works as a strong research method because it generates data which may be social, cultural, historical, spatial, all four. Thirdly, the Rivers of Reading is strong because of the river metaphor. Drawing a reading journey as a river with weather features and landmarks as staging posts means students are designing their personal reading histories. And as Harold Rosen says, it's the imposition of design on events which makes the difference. Here are some landmarks on Lily's River of Reading. So just from this one collage or drawing, there was social information. For example, it's a bit too small for you to see, but she writes, "My dad got the whole series of Old Bear for me when I was ill in hospital." Or, "My sister taught me to read in my head. Mr. Birthday is the first book to read in my head." It's mind-boggling to work out how did her sister teach her to read in her head. But Michael Morpurgo's Twist of Gold was amazing. I read it 6 times. I read When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, and it really helped me to understand what happened in the war, so cultural knowledge being gained that way. And then her history is interesting. I found Enid Blyton's books really difficult the first couple of times I read them. Then I found them easy. I started off by reading one book by Roald Dahl. Then I got one every year for Christmas. I enjoyed and still enjoy reading Harry Potter books. Noughts and Crosses was the first book I cried when I read. So in this one collage, we learn so much. And interestingly, I think Lily seemed to learn as well. Some of these things were things that she was probably thinking for the first time. I don't know whether she'd describe it like this, but I think a river of reading par excellence is Margaret's new book, which I urge you to read if you haven't already, One Child Reading, My Autobiography. It's the culmination of several years' work on which Margaret, as many of us know, has been engaged. She's researched as much as she can of the landscape of her own reading history, or literacy history, really, I should say, between the ages of 1 to 13. Her account weaves back and forth between past memories and present rereadings to remind us of just how fiendishly complex any such endeavour is and how subject to the ravages of time, misremembering and so on it might be. But reading journals can generate rich data, but also record it. As a teacher, I've always found I had much to learn from reading them. For example, here's an interesting journal entry written by a Year 10 student in a class that was studying Jane Eyre. "We just read the episode in which Jane is locked in the Red Room by her aunt, and this passage occurs. I had to cross before the looking glass. My fascinated gaze glance involuntarily explored the depth it revealed. All looked colder and darker in that visionary hollow than in reality. And the strange little figure there, gazing at me with a white face and arms speckling the gloom and glittering eyes of fear moving where all else was still, had the effect of a real spirit. The student wrote in her journal that when she read this bit, she felt as if she herself was approaching the looking glass. She herself was looking into the looking glass. But what she saw in it was Jane Eyre's face, not her own. That visionary hollow, as Charlotte Bronte describes the looking glass, seems to me to be like a narrative which can at times produce more intense sensations in the reader than the surrounding reality. However, this particular reader does not become Jane Eyre. She remains herself, but is at one and the same time so closely immersed in the narrative that it's almost, but not quite, as if she had become Jane Eyre. However, what the reading journal tells us is that she can be herself and Jane Eyre simultaneously. Two things can be true. There was and there was not. Journals provide a chance for readers to take a step back and think critically about what they're reading. Journals also provide rich data for researchers. Here is Freya reflecting on her reading of Twilight. I would now love to meet Edward Cullen. He sounds amazing enough for anyone not to be held back by the fact that he is a vampire. Edward reminds me of a saying, if nobody is perfect, I must be nobody, i.e. Edward is nobody, not human, and he is perfect, beautiful, amazing. I want to be Bella. Sad face. She wasn't thinking that she was Bella. She wanted to be her. The book reminds me, she goes on to say, a book reminds me a lot of Edward Scissorhands, a film by Tim Burton. Now I realise it. If I were Bella, I probably would have been worried about this too. So like the student reading Jane Eyre, Freya's journal shows empathy but not identification with the character she's reading about. You can see through her use of modal verbs that she's expressing the subtlety of that empathy. I would love to meet Edward. I want to be Bella, because she knows she's not. If I were Bella, I probably would have been worried. And also, the reading journal seems to be helping her to see things for the first time. The book reminds me of Edward Scissorhands, now I realise. In the introduction to Amnesty International's materials for using fiction to teach human rights, Archbishop Desmond Tutu writes that literature enables us to step into another person's shoes, but crucially, while still remaining ourselves. He argues, though, that empathy can transform the way we think. Through empathy, we overcome prejudice, develop tolerance, and ultimately understand love. Stories can bring understanding, healing, reconciliation, and unity. Reading journals can demonstrate how that empathy works for different readers. Crucially, they draw out young people's distinctiveness and complexity, making it very difficult to cluster them together into simple categories. Teachers are currently in danger of failing to make time for storytelling and for longer works of literature in particular, but not entirely. I've recently been reading the case studies in the new book that was launched here yesterday, or would have been if it had been here to launch, Guiding Readers, Layers of Meaning. The transcripts show groups of children reading and being provoked into talking about a wonderful variety of literary and non-literary texts. They are the lucky ones because they're working with thoughtful adults who are helping them engage with what they and one another are reading and what they're making it mean. They're not just reading extracts and spotting literary techniques. Reading extracts, to my mind, is like watching Match of the Day highlights, rather than experiencing the whole match with its highs and lows, developments and setbacks. If you haven't been in it all through the story, you're not in a good position to reflect on it afterwards, as those who have are. No one can read a story for you. But that doesn't really quite address the question about why stories, dramas and novels in particular still matter, and why they might continue to do so in the future. Peter Boxall's new book, The Value of the Novel, offers some pointers. One of his key ideas is that the novel, as a literary form, offers us compelling ways to imagine the world in which we live, and also has a uniquely powerful capacity to critique the cultures from which it emerges and within which it is read. If novels encourage the capacity to imagine and critique, and if we want young people to broaden their social, cultural, and historical horizons, then I would argue that we should be teaching more contemporary children's and young adults literature, since that's what it does so effectively. We don't then need to rush prematurely into well-worn GCSE texts such as Animal Farm in Year 7. How might young people understand the world around them differently if before reading Animal Farm they read and talked about challenging novels such as the verse novel The Weight of Water by Sarah Crossan? If they read that, they would learn about a young Polish immigrant girl, Kasienka, and her mother coming to live in a one-room flat in Coventry in order to look for her father who has walked out. Kasienka is bullied at school by other girls, but finds the strength to stand up for herself in the end through finding who her true friends are and through what she's good at, which is swimming. The novel is nothing if not about an identity affirmation. I quote, "Water is another world, a land with its own language, which I speak fluently. It's alien and dangerous. I can't even breathe down here. It's the silence I want. And the weight of water over me, around me, the safe silence of submergence. At the pool's edge, I might be ugly, but when I speak strokes, I am beautiful." Or how might young people imagine and critique cultures through The Other Side of Truth by Beverly Naidu? Naidu dedicates The Other Side of Truth to all people, all young people who want to know more. As a novel, it helps readers not only to know, but potentially to understand more as well. It offers multiple perspectives on life in London as a refugee from Nigeria. It explores the idea that truth is not singular, but multifaceted. Femi and Sade's father can be both a truth-telling Nigerian journalist and a man who has to lie to smuggle his children out of the country. Two things can be true. Or what about Postcards from No Man's Land by Aidan Chambers? Postcards is a multi-layered, multi-narrative, intertextual novel which explores the encounters between Dutch and British soldiers and civilians at the time of the Battle of Arnhem in 1944, and encounters between Dutch and British young people today. It addresses military and human complexities. Its readers can imagine and critique what it means to be a young European in Holland today. Chambers allows his readers to do exactly what Boxall says, which is to imagine and critique cultures about and from within which they read. He leaves them to make up their own minds too. Philip Davis in Reading and the Reader argues that reading should be seen as a holding ground. A holding ground is a place at the bottom of the sea where a ship's anchor can gain purchase. Davis says that reading offers us a holding ground for investigation and contemplation, for thinking thoughts. If he's right, then do we not want as many young people as possible to read the kinds of novels I've just described, so they can use them as a holding ground to explore their developing ideas about the world they live in right now? Robin Talley, winner of the 2016 Amnesty Sillip Honour with Lies We Tell Ourselves, wrote in a blog recently posted on the Amnesty website, "Teenagers are passionate about this world and their role in it. They know its future is in their hands. And the more they read, the wider they'll understand that world to be." There are, of course, all sorts of texts which can act as a holding ground, allowing us space to reflect on the world we inhabit. But my argument this morning has been mainly that good stories, novels and drama act as a holding ground in particularly valuable ways. They bring the imagined and the real together over time. They enable readers to acquire textual power. And textual power is one of the chief things young people will need to sustain themselves into the future. However, other texts may do that equally well. Robert McFarlane writes wonderful non-fiction. His books, such as The Wild Places or Landmarks, have led many readers to think differently about places and environments. These texts and others like them provide us with different kinds of space for contemplation, not least about the future. In an article for The Guardian earlier this year, McFarlane made two particularly disturbing observations about the period he argues we're living in now. This period has been called the Anthropocene period, which he defines as a new epoch of geological time in which human activity is considered such a powerful influence on the environment, climate, and ecology of the planet that it will leave a long-term signature in the strata record. The first of Macfarlane's observations is about the powerlessness of literature to cope with the enormity of the environmental challenges we face. How, he says, might a novel or a poem possibly account for our authorship of global-scale environmental change across millennia, let alone shape the nature of that change? The indifferent scale of the Anthropocene can induce a crushing sense of the cultural sphere's impotence. The second observation is even more chilling. In 1981, a group of interdisciplinary experts were tasked with preventing future humans from intruding onto a subterranean storage facility for radioactive waste, then under construction in the New Mexico desert. The half-life of plutonium-239 is around 24,100 years. The written history of humanity is around 5,000 years old. The challenge facing the group was how to devise a sign system that could semantically survive even catastrophic phases of planetary future and that could communicate with an unknown humanoid to be. In other words, who will tell a story in 24,116? I'm going to finish by reading Philip Gross's poem, Severn Song, about the River Severn. It makes me think about the way the stories people tell and their rivers of reading are integrally linked to their cultures and histories. It reminds me of Harold's point that we are our stories. If teaching stories, novels, and drama helps students learn that different things can be true simultaneously, then research into storytelling, novels, and drama also helps us understand why and why that might matter. This poem is dedicated by the poet to John Carl Gross, his father, who was an Estonian refugee who I think came to the United Kingdom at the end of the Second World War. Although the father could once speak five languages, in later life he lost all capacity for any kind of language at all. Severn Song by Philip Gross. The Severn was brown and the Severn was blue. Not this, then that, not either or, no mixture. Two things can be true. The hills were clouds and the mist was a shore. The Severn was water, and the water was mud, whose eddies stood and did not fill, the kind of water that's thicker than blood. The river was flowing, the flowing was still. The tide rip, the sound of dry fluttering wings with waves that did not break or fall. We were two of the world's small particular things. We were old, we were young, we were no age at all. For a moment, not doing, nor coming undone, words gained, words lost, till who's to say which was the father, which was the son, a week or 50 years away? But the water said earth and the water said sky. We were everyone we'd ever been or would be. Every angle of light that says you, that says I, and the sea was the river, the sea.
No time for questions, but you've left it with such a compelling and insightful analysis, so many stories and images to take with us that will remain with us, I know, and inform our work and thinking for so long to come. There's so much to talk about we can't begin to, but please can you just join me in thanking Gabrielle.
Well, that's it. What a weekend. I have just three things to say and I shall count them down. The first thing to say is that the Books for Africa total is, let me find it, £554.75, which is absolutely marvellous and all down to you. Here's the challenge. Can we make it six? Just outside, there is a little collection, well, actually it's quite a big collection, of books in little piles on tables with a bag nearby. The challenge is to donate, take a book, and then, on the way home, give the gift of reading. Wouldn't that be marvellous? Couldn't you just see up and down the country motorway service toilets filled with gifts of reading? That sounds really bad. But you could take a photograph of the location of where you've left your book and then tweet it to Here's the Book at UKLA. So something to think about. Just get that £600. Second. Some marvellous seminars that you have attended this week. If there is that opportunity for translating those seminars into an article for either literacy or for English 4 to 11, there could be something really, really worthwhile of ensuring that this conference has a bit of longevity beyond our memories. So that is some, please do think about that, and if you are interested, if you could contact the editors of either of those publications. And finally, just thank you. It has been a superb weekend, wonderful keynotes and performances, which all proved to be extraordinary, and they were extraordinary shared moments, and some of which will be imprinted on my memory for a very, very long time. I just want to thank you all for participating and for providing us with such a wide range of thought-provoking, huge, high-quality workshops, seminars and research reports. These have encouraged us to engage in discussions and debates, allowing us to all bring our voices together. And I think we should do it again next year, but in Glasgow. I look forward to seeing you all. Safe journeys home.